Son. We ask you all of these. Amen.
Amen. Okay, so we talked briefly on Sunday just about the idea of being in our bodies and being grounded in our bodies. That God made us body and mind together. We don't want those, you know, separated from each other. And I didn't give this as homework this quarter, but last quarter I had people read Song of Solomon. And the question was, just read the Song of Solomon and then look for the mind-body connection. How do people feel about their bodies? Do you get the sense these people are in their bodies, grounded in their bodies? And of course, I think the answer to that would be yes to that final question. I didn't feel like it was the greatest homework assignment, so I didn't assign it for us this quarter. But no surprise, you see things in the Song of Solomon, like romance is experienced with the whole body, right? Your voice is sweet, your face is lovely, let me hear your voice. You've captivated my heart. You've captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes. So the idea of sick with love, of course, is this mind and body thing together. And I suggest you very much get the sense these people are in their bodies in a healthy way. And so I just want to share those ideas of kind of this mind-body connection, I think is exemplified in a large part here in Song of Solomon. Be drunk with love, right? This intoxicating nature of love. So I just wanted to mention that as kind of an addendum to what we hit on Sunday. Okay, so here was the homework video. Dr. Yapko, I hope you got to spend a little bit of time with him last few days. And the point of that homework was to see the biopsychosocial model of mental health in action. Any surprises? And then, even though it's not from a Christian's perspective, does his basic model align with Bible principles? So those questions, your thoughts on that? Good, bad, you liked it, you hated it, you're welcome to share what you think with that.
How little, like the data of how comparing to child depression makes it,
like increases.
Yeah, increases your chances, but like how tiny it was because of actual genetics versus the reality of that is because of what they see, because nurture, basically.
So nurture, and it could be nurture in a few ways, right? It could be nurture based on the relationship itself, that the relationship itself is not, to use our words for the quarter, is not stable and stabilizing, is not encouraging. Mom is disconnected, and so her kids are disconnected, et cetera. Or it could be shared and, what's the word he used? I'm sorry, it's not coming
contagious.
To me. Contagious. It could be contagious because you just learn to think like the people around you, right? So when something bad happens, it's disaster, right? When mom says or dad says, my friend didn't call me, that's the end of the world. Well, a kid learns that. So it could be modeling or it could be actually the relationship piece. But either way, that idea of depression being learned, I think is huge and very important for us to see. That's just what the Bible says. We talked about this before, right? How from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to his brothers, sin problems just get worse and worse. Well, brokenness gets worse and worse, you know that kind of thing. Good. Other things that jumped out to you, Darla?
Well, it was just interesting to me. I don't know how long. Do you know how long ago the video was made?
Seven? Years. It was pre-COVID, yeah.
Without being at all pointed about it, because that wasn't the agenda, it was very anti-woke.
Okay.
Because it was about facts. You need to base your response to on facts.
Yeah.
You need to not let your emotions take over.
Yes.
It was just I was just really amazed how just grounded it was.
Yeah.
And
so if you make decisions,
truth.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you make decisions based on how you feel in the moment, that's not gonna lead you in a good way. That it's better to rely, he didn't use the word wisdom, but rely on facts, on what you know, not what you feel, those kind of things. And so you're right, I hadn't put that word with it, anti-woke, but you're right, it's not the kind of post-COVID transgender, like whatever you feel you are, you know, kind of thing. Good, other thoughts? Yeah, Stephen.
I really enjoyed it because it seemed to me like it was real information. It wasn't full of statistics, it wasn't full of theories, it wasn't full of ideas. It really seemed like I could listen to it over and over again and pick up something different each each
yes.
time.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd love to sit at the guy's feet to learn just more depth on each topic that he gave. So I felt like it was really good, solid information. It wasn't just, you know, in some of these seminars, there's just kind of this general ideas to try to bait you in and hook you. Or
yeah,
something.
Like more pep talk or something.
Yeah,
yeah,
it really did feel like he, like Darla said and all the others, that there was actual evidence. And I was surprised on how much evidence he had put in that short of a time frame.
Yeah, and one of the things he does that every counselor of any stripe, any counselor should do, is be giving things like homework, right? It's not just about a conversation once a week. It's really about the homework that you're doing on a daily basis. Okay, Lori?
Something that he emphasized that you do, and this is my opportunity to tell you how important I think it is. It's the idea that it's not, some of us tend to be more all or nothing
mm-hmm.
kind of thinkers, like it's got to be fixed. You know, it's got to be fixed before I can make progress. But
yeah,
he
yeah.
doesn't. He said you have to manage your moods, just like you have to do exercise over
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. and
over. You know, you have to just keep going. And you may never. You know, you said last time we may never get to where you think you're great.
Yeah, or
like
as stable as you'd
making,
like to be.
Exactly,
yeah, yeah.
You're making progress, and you're managing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really helpful to me.
Yeah, yeah. If we have moods, we'll have mood disorders and have mood problems. And so, of course, if we can learn, if possible, to guide some of those things by growing, I do think Christians should have a step ahead of other worldviews. If we can be growing that to where we're learning when those things are little, or we're helping our kids when they're little, whatever. That's going to be better than just helping people when they're in the pit.
And right. If we have a bad day, or we have a bad week, or whatever, it doesn't mean we're failing. We know we have tools.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's where wisdom comes in. So you learn about things. I say this a lot. What goes up must come down. And you're like, I came back from vacation, and I'm so depressed. Like, yeah, that's what happens when you've been up all week. Like, you're going to crash afterwards. You're, you know, your adrenaline's going to run out. You're going to come home, and you're going to be depressed. That's just naturally going to happen. It makes us wonder if, you know, it's so great an idea to go on all those vacations if we're so depressed afterwards. But that just becomes common sense. You're like, oh, not going to expect that. Like, I'm going to hate my job for a week after I get back from vacation, and that kind of thing. Okay, did you have a hand, Chuck? Okay, yeah, no. Wait, what?
Talking about the effects of exercise on the body in comparison to like antidepressants and stuff like that, I think that needs to be expressed a lot more in today's society.
Yeah, yeah. If you go back 30 years, it was the model was basically we're just brain chemicals, so how do you fix it? With chemicals. And we're just more complicated. Humans, our makeup and how God made us, is more complicated than that. So can that be helpful? Yes. But as I think his presentation is, there's just so much more to it than that, right? Skills over pills is that idea. So, okay, use that as part of your arsenal, but then don't, it's not all or nothing with that for sure. You know, absolutely. Yeah, Heather.
I really appreciated that he said, because we're all different, what got us in is not gonna be the same, and what gets us out
mm-hmm.
is not gonna be the same. So I think that's helpful. Expectation for myself, if somebody else tells me, well, this is what I did,
mm-hmm,
not
mm-hmm.
to expect, oh, well, that necessarily is going to help me. And also would help me if somebody comes to me and says, I'm struggling. I can't just say, well, this is what I did. Here's
yeah.
the formula. That it's just not going to be that way, which calls on us to really rely on God, His Word, His Spirit to lead us.
Mm-hmm.
But then also calls on us to be in relationship with
mm-hmm.
one another, to walk through really messy times.
Yes, right. Not looking for any kind of silver bullet magic pill, right? One size fits all thing. One Christian I know who counsels people said the biggest mistake you can make as a counselor is to assume coming into session number one, you know how you're going to solve this problem. You don't. You don't really know that going in until you know them and learn their situation and, you know, all that kind of thing. Okay, yeah, Gary.
I thought it was really good. I mean, I certainly am not familiar with a lot of the clinical terms that he
yes.
used.
Some of it's pretty specific, yeah.
But he did it in a pretty simplistic manner to which like if he laid out a scenario, I mean, you could plainly see how 2 + 2 = 4, you know, and make your assumptions, you know, on a lot of those points that he was making. I mean, even for a simple-minded person like me, I understood quite a bit of it, so.
Yeah.
I noticed down in the corner where it said APS, it was Australian Psychological Society.
Yes.
Is he Australian?
He's not. He's American.
Okay.
He's speaking in Australia.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, good question. I didn't know that first. I'm like, is there an accent? Does he have an Australian accent? And so, no. So, if you look him up, he's an American. I forget where he's from. And
well, I will say, your first line up there that says, any surprises on the data he presented, the only thing that surprised me was that at 47 minutes, he decided to get on a political soapbox.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, really? Here we go.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Referencing,
yeah,
something about Donald Trump
being a serial. But even at that, I mean, a lot of people, you know, we get onto sports stars and we, you know, for taking their platform and using it for a political, you know, soapbox. And then, I don't know, I thought that it could have been done without that very just as easily, but
no, he didn't need to make that point, that's for sure. Good. Other things that struck you from, Lauren.
You do have some control, not that you can just make yourself not be depressed, but he gave very actionable steps that, and I think when I've had times where I've struggled, like knowing that it's not just something that's happening to me and I just have to sit and let it happen, I'm in control, or I have to be dependent on medication, but like having an action plan of what I can do, it is just helpful in and of itself, even if I don't actually implement the action plan, just knowing that they have some control over that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of where the homework piece we're talking about comes in, where any good counselor is giving you things. Hey, I want you to do this maybe every day or between now and when we talk next. There is stuff to work on, but then just like the doing of that and saying, oh, like I need to be doing stuff about this is just practical. I mentioned last time the preacher I talked to that had panic attacks, and he was surprised that after our first conversation, I gave him homework. He's like, oh. Okay, great. Like, yeah, I can work on this. You know, that kind of thing. That's very helpful. It's hope building. It's enabling, you know, enabling in a good way. Right. Right. Yeah, Heather.
Well, to Warren's point, it wasn't biblical, but it's definitely a biblical model that God doesn't tell us to always view ourselves as sinners. Instead, he says, well, you were those things.
Mm-hmm,
now,
mm-hmm.
You're redeemed. You're washed. So God doesn't tell me. The way for you to not sin is to every day go, oh, I'm a sinner, I'm a sinner, I'm horrible, this is awful. No, it's to find hope in this new identity.
Yes.
You've seen a little shift even with the AA model to now the Celebrate Recovery model, where they're shifting away a little bit. Instead of, you know, Heather and I have been an alcoholic for 40 years, like, but I mean, I've been sober for 39. That's still my main identity.
Yes.
Celebrate Recovery has taken a different route of let's celebrate where we are and not constantly reinforcing.
Yes.
That.
Yes, absolutely. I really like Colossians 3 for that point. Okay, so now you are holy and beloved. So then put on these new things. You know, this is a new identity you have. So you guys are giving away my big points from later on in the quarter. About 2 months from now, we'll talk about some of the defining things that help us out of the pit, and that is we need to see ourselves as God sees us. Or I need to retell my story how God sees my story. So those principles, I think, are very encouraging, very biblical, new identity, action plan, those kinds of things. Yeah, Jen.
I thought it was encouraging about the study they did with the children who were given some tools about how to deal with things in their life that prevented or helped them escape depression when some of their peers were in the same situations, like succumbed to that.
Yeah.
I'm just hopeful that giving kids tools can be helpful. Yeah.
Yes, and I think that goes again into this relationship aspect. Societies are probably either pushing people towards helping them be more normal, or helping people be anxious, or helping people be depressed. And the whole society that's kind of enabling depression, that's not a good direction. So what are the things we're telling ourselves that kind of feed depression? And if we can rescue kids from thinking that way, you know, that kind of idea. Yeah, Phoebe.
I like how you mentioned the media, like social media, about depression, because you can see it with multiple different things. Like,
yeah.
There was a huge study about people thinking that they were autistic and ADHD because people were giving, like, those videos that's like, if you're tired, you have ADHD. I'm like, oh my word, I'm tired right now. I'm ADHD. It's like, no. And even with Tourette's, where people were almost catching Tourette's, that was interesting. But it's social media where you can see, like, things being contagious to you.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to know yourself instead of going to social media for answers.
Yeah, and social media is disastrous in so many ways. Social media is particularly disastrous to young ladies because they're more relational oriented, and so their concept of am I liked, am I, you know, all those relationships is based on how much likes I get. All those things are just really bad. The boys, on the other hand, they're the more dopamine driven and, you know, the video game kind of drive. That's, you know, eating their brains, you know. So, yeah, Jen.
I thought some of that dovetailed nicely with The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. Like,
yeah.
More about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so I think his presentation's actually more notable because he's not coming at it from a Christian perspective. You know, he's not saying, you know, hi, I'm a Christian, and, you know, obviously there's value to that, but I think it's notable that he's just looking at the evidence and saying, we're not just chemicals. Our thinking matters. Our relationships matter, right? So obviously I don't agree with everything he says. And it's easy to talk about helpful treatments and plans. It's very different to use them, very different to see them in action. Some plans sound great. Some of his ideas of specific strategies, I'm like, okay, that sounds good. Does that really get to the root of the problem, et cetera? So sometimes those, you watch a video like, oh man, that's amazing. It's a very different thing to actually put it into practice. You know, and I'll say this is not the video I'd show someone first conversation. Oh, I meet you in the parking lot. Oh, you have depression? Oh, let me send you this video. You know, it's not that kind of video. Obviously, first conversations, you're wanting to find out where they're at, meet them with compassion, you know, all of that. But I think it makes a compelling argument for the biopsychosocial approach to dealing with depression. Biological factors, he said, beware of. Genetics, not huge, but there. No alcohol, he said, right? I remember the guy who came to me years ago, he's like, and then it struck me, when you're drinking, you are drinking a depressant. It's like, yeah. You know, like he's like this light bulb moment, right? Get exercise, get sleep, get rest, meds might help. There's thinking factors. How do I think about myself? How do I think about my past? How do I process the things that happened to me? Am I flexible or am I rigid in my thinking? Flexible or rigid my approach to life. Recognize that mood impacts my thinking and my decision making, right? Social factors. Are depressed people making me depressed? Here's a line. Depressed spouses make spouses depressed. That's just inevitable, right? You live with someone who's depressed. You touched on this. That's going to be hard for you. That doesn't mean you're going to get pulled down the same level. That's going to be a challenge, right? Did I learn things from my parents that aren't serving me well, right? Am I comparing myself to others, like on social media? Are there relationship expectations? Hey, you know, you're supposed to be a helpmeet. You know, why aren't you as good a wife as you're supposed to be? And you're putting these expectations on someone else. Are you spending good time with good people? So all of those things impact us, not just one. And I think what's really encouraging about a leading expert on depression, he was asked to write in this Encyclopedia Britannica, right? Mm-hmm. A leading expert on depression giving what is a much more biblical perspective on how the world works, how we work as humans, than this model that was so big 20, 30, 40 years ago, and we're just a lot of chemicals, so we fix everything with chemicals, right? Okay, so I'm about to wrap that up. Remember, the focus of that was not the depression piece of it, but to see the biopsychosocial model and kind of how relationships impact us, how thinking impacts us. And we're going to be going here in these next few slides into now the relationship, because we've already looked at the mind-body thing. But before I wrap that up, any other burning observations? Yeah, Abby.
Kind of what you're leading into, one of the things I noticed about his video is he talked about the reality test
mm-hmm.
and how how important it is to have good, healthy relationships around you to help with that.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard a lot, what do you want to make that mean? And that's a really good question with things that you look at in your past, how you were raised, and what kind of meaning you attach to things. Because
yes.
It can really take you down fast.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and we'll get into that a little bit, I think, today. The significance of those things, that's how God and his redemption makes these things so beautiful, is because I'm not just my past. I can be something very different from my past. And in fact, I can look back and be healed from that and be something far greater than my past. And, you know, the world just doesn't have that kind of redemption, rebirth to offer, right? So that, I think that's a very powerful thing. So, excellent. Anything else that someone wanted to say based on that? Okay, so we've been talking about mind and body, soul, spirit, flesh, my thinking, my heart, my feeling. We talked about emotions a little bit, although we'll come back to that. We're talking about getting out of the pit. So now the final piece of this is then this relationship piece of all of this. So when we say relationship, that's the social, biopsychosocial. I don't mean how a relationship looks, right? It's not about, oh, it looks like a good friendship, or it looks like a bad marriage. It could be a good friendship, even though it looks bad, or vice versa, right? Your friendship might look fine, but in your heart, it's quite discouraging. We get that, right? We get that. We could be a part of a church where everything looks fine, but it's actually quite discouraging. I think it's notable that married couples might have a conflict resolution to you that just looks like they're always fighting, and they're actually fine with it. I'm not saying that's ideal. But it doesn't mean that there's necessarily a relationship problem. They're just used to handling conflict when other people are around. They're used to handling conflict in a way where there's some words, but then the relationship actually is stable. So I'm not recommending that, but just because it looks like they have conflict, it could be their relationship is quite stable. It's really about if you've had and currently have supportive relationships in your life, right? That's what it's about. Have you had and do you have supportive, encouraging relationships? When we say relationships, we don't mean with living people necessarily, right? And in fact, all the people whose relationship is most impactful to you may all be dead, right? So I think about, my grandma who just passed at 96. You know, her parents are long gone, almost all of her friends long gone. But her kids, those are impactful relationships, and her kids being kind to her in her old age was an encouraging thing to her, But when we talk about like your top 10 life relationships for my grandma, most of those were relationships with their long past. Her husband, my grandfather, died in 2010, so she'd been a widow for like 15 years. I guarantee you, even though he's been gone for 15 years, there are elements of that relationship that are still a part of her heart, right? Things that she learned for the better or for the worse that were still impactful, even though he's been gone for a long time. So it's the people in our life who we have the strongest connection to. It could just be people in general, our connection to people. But people, more than we probably realize, have a huge impact on our emotions and our thinking and our body. So that's this big piece that one of the things I really like to be a takeaway from this quarter is a greater emphasis on relationships and how needed those are, how important good relationships are to our life that stabilize our thinking, stabilize our emotions, and things like that. So here's a study on World War II kids. You may have heard this before. Remember like the Narnia kids, where there's bombing in London, so they send the kids out of London in World War II out to be in the villages and far away so that they're not bombed and killed. And so there was a lot of that, sending of kids out of London when he was being bombarded by the Nazis. Well, that sounds like a good idea, right? Save the kids, send them to safer places. Environmentally, London was scary. London's traumatic, right? These kids are every night worried for their life. So clearly they're gonna be more at peace, right? Well, guess what they found? What they found was the evacuated children taken away from their parents were more negatively impacted long-term than those who got to stay with their parents. In other words, it sounds like a good idea because it's a scary place. Send them to be with strangers, but guess what? Long term, it's better to be with your parents in a scary place than to be in a safe place but without your parents. And that was true the younger they were. So
not as much the teenagers, was that true? Or even middle school, I don't remember the data on that, but anyways, the younger that they were, the bigger a deal that was. And so that, I think that kind of wisdom should tell us a lot about what our home needs to be, right? Our home needs to be a place that is loving and safe and encouraging, and then we can handle craziness in the world, right? They'll be fine, as long as the home is providing the encouragement and the nourishment that's needed. Yeah, Stephen, did you have a...
I had a question, but I found the answer up there. So.
Okay. Well, good. Yeah, okay. I always think about what Tim Bunting said about living in New York. This is not the direct quote, but the idea is, what's hard about living in the city is not the annoyances of the subway or the traffic or everything being dirty, it's the people. If the people weren't so terrible, New York City would be a wonderful place to live. And it's really true. If the people were wonderful, you could handle all the awfulness, all the dirt and the congestion. It's the people, it's the meanness, it's the callousness, all that makes it so hard. Okay, back to our favorite wordy author here, Dr. Thompson. The mind is as relational as it is embodied. So remember, his point from Sunday was that the mind is embodied both in the brain and throughout the body, but it's as relational as it is embodied. By this, I mean that the emergence of the mind's capacity to do what it does is crucially dependent on the presence of relationships. If you remember, Dr. Thompson's specialty is interpersonal neurobiology, in other words, how the brain responds with other people, right? From the day we enter the world, our neurons are firing, not only out of the depths of genetically influenced patterns, but in direct response to the myriad of social interactions we sense and perceive when we encounter other people. Not only this, but data from the field of epigenetics, that's turning genes on and off, now suggests that human experience has the capacity to turn genes on and off. In this way, our relational interactions can actually influence our lives at the most basic biological level. In other words, well, you can't change someone who they are genetically. Well, you can, because epigenetics is how you're processing which genes to turn on and which ones to turn off. So human experience and relationships are actually influencing us at the most basic biological levels. Thus, the way our neurological system wires its responses to various emotional experiences is significantly influenced by the relational context in which these emotions arise. It's wordy, I get that. But I think that there's just some really helpful things in there. And here he goes back to the Bible. This way of comprehending the healthy development of the mind reminds us of the Genesis narrative, which declares that we mysteriously hewn creatures are both dust and breath. We are inseparably embodied and relational. In other words, Genesis 2, God didn't just breathe life into us, he also gave us relationships, right? Man and woman, us with God. Furthermore, this feature of integration is reflected in the psalmist's plea that God would give him an undivided heart, Psalm 86:11. In God's deep desire to do so while transforming hardened, disintegrated hearts into flexible, connected ones, Ezekiel 11. So when Ezekiel talks about God will soften their hearts and give them a soft heart, right? So here's an article that there's some copies here, and I just need to make more copies after class if you're interested in this. But this is a long-standing Harvard study. Have you heard of the Harvard Longitudinal Study before? Has anyone heard of that? So like I said, there's copies of it for you to look at. So it's one of the world's longest long-term longitudinal studies back in Harvard back in the like 40s. Interesting, that was when JFK was at Harvard, so he was one of the people in the study of those initial people. So this is seeing how God made us, the biopsychosocial model at work. So Harvard did a huge study examining men and then their kids and their grandkids for 80 years. And what they found is that relationships have a huge impact on our health. The surprising find is that our relationships and how happy we are in our relationships has a powerful influence on our health. What did Dr. Yapko say about that? That the depression is one of the leading factors of heart disease, right? Of heart disease. So this is similar. This is kind of along the same similar lines. These are quotes from the article. Close relationships, more than money or fame, are what keep people happy throughout their lives, the study reveals. Those close relationships, those ties, protect people from life's discontents, help delay mental and physical decline,
and are better predictors of long and happy lives than social class, IQ, or even genes. So what's more important than social class, IQ, money, fame, even your genetics, are good, close relationships, right? When we gathered together everything we knew about them at age 50, after the study being going on, it wasn't their middle-aged cholesterol levels that predicted how they were going to grow old, said the guy in his TED talk on this topic. It was how satisfied they were in their relationships. The people who were the most satisfied in their relationships at age 50 were the healthiest at age 80. The researchers also found that marital satisfaction has a protective effect on people's mental health. So this is interesting. Part of the study found that people who had happy marriages in their 80s reported that their moods didn't suffer even on days when they had more physical pain. Those who had unhappy marriages felt both more emotional and physical pain. Okay, same pain. Let's say you throw your back out, right? People in their 80s, the people who were had good marriages, that same amount of pain didn't impact their mood as much as that same pain level for those who were alone or who had bad marriages. So those who had unhappy marriages felt both more emotional and physical pain, right? So it's pretty significant. Those who kept warm relationships got to live longer and happier, said Waldinger, and the loners often died earlier. Loneliness kills. It's as powerful as smoking or alcoholism. And we saw that with COVID, right? The loneliness impacting people during COVID. When the study began, back in the 50s or whatever, nobody cared about empathy or attachment, right? That wasn't the focus of their study. But the key to healthy aging is relationships, relationships, relationships. Now, can we see God's wisdom in his plan for his people in all this? Right? What makes you think about this from a biblical perspective that more important than, you know, smoking and money and all that, to grow old and to live longer and be happier are good relationships? Where does your mind go in a biblical context?
Family.
Family. Family and church and Genesis 2, right? Two becoming one in a what a good relationship would be is a marriage of love and taking care of each other. Good. Yeah. Yeah, Heather.
Well, God himself is in community, God the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So if we're made in his image, we're made for community.
Yes.
We'll never fulfill being that if we're isolated.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, very good. So all those things are just very relevant and just really part of how God has made us. So we desperately need stable and stabilizing relationships. And that's the terminology that I prefer with this. Stable relationships, people you can depend on, who can be dependable, people whom you can lean on, right? That, you know, I'll use Josh as an example. Josh has been helpful with my car problems, with other problems, all kinds of problems, right? Well, if it's like, oh no, my car is broken down. Oh good, I have friends that help me with that. Oof, what if Josh is in a bad mood today? Like what if Josh is, you know, what if Josh doesn't like me today? What if Josh is drunk today? Like all those things, right? So it's not great to have friends that can help you if they're not stable. If, you know, if you can't depend on them, right? Oh yeah, Judy, I'll be over there. And he never comes over, you know, or something like that, you know? So stable relationships. And then when we have stable relationships, it becomes stabilizing. People who can be helpful, strong, encouraging. We are stabilized when we have these good, stable relationships. If we don't have stable people and stabilizing relationships, we pretty quickly fall apart. There's a pattern that Julianne and I've seen through the years where there was a lady that we cared about deeply in New York City, and that church up there was not a stable church. That wasn't good for her. When the church was stable, she did fine. When the church had problems, it was so hard for her. It was like she needed that church family to be stable for her. And then you tend to see that maybe not in as dramatic as we saw with her, but you see that with other people, right? Where it's like, oh, their church, everything's good. And then there's not much of a, you know, whiff of struggle or something. Whew, they're out of there, you know. And so we need those stable people and stabilizing relationships. So, of course, all of this starts off with we need a connection to our parents. We're very young. Our parents, or those primary caregivers, were our entire world, right? Especially mom at first. So that is where we start. And those primary people, you know, how was that for us? Was that stable? Was that encouraging, loving, all those things?
In the home, were those relationships stabilizing or were they stressful? Were they destabilizing? You know, so you show me someone who struggles with anxiety, depression, you name it. I'll show you someone who has unstable, destabilizing relationships that they need more help, right? Could you lean on your parent to be stronger than you, to be there for you, to be more mature than you? I think that's huge, right? When the parents aren't being the parent, that's so hard on the kids when they have to be the mature one. Can you lean on them? Or are you kind of at the mercy of dad's mood, right? Sometimes dad's fun, sometimes dad's mean. Well, that's not very stable. That's not gonna be very stabilizing for them. So are they the parent? Are they the strong ones? Could you lean on them in those ways? Did you have a healthy attachment to your parents, right? All kinds of ways the parents can foolishly and unhelpfully attach to their,
5 minute warning,
their kids. So this is the idea of parental imprinting. And this is pretty big. Okay, when you have seen pictures or stories like this, where the first thing that a duck sees is a person, what does the duck end up believing? That it's his parent, and therefore he's a human, right? He's a person, right? So the first thing these duckies see is this nice guy, and they're like, "Well, that's mommy," and you know the old P.D. Eastman, "Are you my mother?" Right? So this is mommy, and they're following him around because that's the idea of imprinting, is they've deep down gotten something stamped on them that's actually not accurate, right? That's my mommy, that's who I am, right? It's not accurate. So you can see where we're going with this. Parental imprinting is when we learn stuff from our parents that gets imprinted on our hearts that may not be that accurate. Parents teach us what normal is. Parents teach us what is important. Parents teach us values. And they don't have a list of them hanging on the refrigerator. Probably the list of ones on the refrigerator aren't even the realest ones, right? And so, you know, we put God first, except when anything comes in conflict, and then we don't put God first, you know. So we learn what normal is, right? Different families will do different things differently. And you thought your family, every family surely sits at the same place at dinner every night. And you hang out with a family and they never sit at the same place. And you're like, what's wrong with you weirdos? Like, don't you have a spot? And they're like, no. What, you sit in the same place every night? You know, bunch of, you know, commies, you know? So all the, you know, we learn different values. What's really important, right? So here's where it becomes challenging. Shaking off what your parents taught you about this world, shaking off what your parents taught you about yourself is very difficult to do. Why is that so difficult to do, to shake off what your parents taught you about yourself?
It's
what you've been told,
seems,
and
like
it's
the
real.
It's your foundation.
It's your foundation, all those things. So what if your parents taught you that Johnny doesn't make any mistakes, it's never Johnny's fault, and you know, Johnny's perfect, and don't tell me Johnny was bad at school. Is that good for a kid to learn that? Okay, what about a good, healthy home of love, and we love you, and we care about you, we take care of your needs, everything's gonna be okay, you're not teaching them depressed ideas like the world's about to collapse, you're teaching them everything's gonna be fine, and God is good, and God's people are good. Do you think that is a deep imprinting on the heart? Absolutely. What if your parents teach you, push come to shove, you're kind of a pain, we kind of don't really love you, why do you have problems, stop having problems, you know, get in line, you know, all those things, right? So to change what your parents taught you about yourself, I think this is a good way to say it, it feels like betrayal to your core values. Whether or not you realize it's like, my core values are that I'm a loser and people shouldn't love me, you know, that kind of thing. You know, even if your core value is you're unlovable, you're worthless, you should be ignored, you've been taught that that's what reality is. So that's really hard to overcome. That's the parental imprinting, right? People in those sad situations, it's like they're a duck who, I think I'm a human. You know, well, we've been taught I should be ignored, people shouldn't love me, and it's really hard to change that. We can, but that's just really hard. Before the clock runs out, let me just mention this. Obviously, where we're going with some of this is we're wanting to make God our most stabilizing relationship.
trying to make God to be our number one relationship. That's what this homework is about. We're kind of getting there in these slides, but make sure you pick up the homework on the way out, because that's what the homework is thinking about that. So a quote I came across a long time ago, I can't find it, I maybe made it up. People thought they found it for me. I'm like, no, that's not the quote. It's this: the emotional pool that you're swimming in is the quality of the 10 most significant relationships you've had in your life. Those deepest significant relationships, that's the emotional pool you're swimming in. Doesn't mean you can't overcome it, but that's what's kind of going around. So this kind of goes hand in hand with the fact we're always in some kind of emotional state, right? Do you carry around with you kind of an anxiety that doom's about to happen? Or do you carry around with you positivity? Everything's going to be fine. So what about our relationship with God, right? Ideally, as Christians, we say God is our rock, God is our refuge, God is our strength, God is our most important relationship. And absolutely, ideally, God is the top relationship out of those top 10. And ideally, God is the most stable and stabilizing relationship that we have. But is that always the case? Of course not, right? We're trying to grow in that. What are some challenges we face in our relationship with God? So that's the homework is.
End of class.
I want us to think about that. Think about what makes it hard. What makes it hard to make God our friend, our rock, our refuge? List at least four reasons you can think about that our relationship with God is not always our number one stable and stabilizing relationship. Why is it hard to make God number one? What can keep us from making God our number one? What can keep my relationship with God from being stable and stabilizing? So there's a lot we can say about that, but that's the goal for Sunday, is kind of think through, okay, well, why isn't he just magically, poof, my number one? And what are some challenges with that? Of course, challenges that then we can overcome. Okay, thank you all so much.